are still under that same gray blanket we've been under now for several days, but who can complain about the temperatures? Amazing, amazing, amazing. Here we are, December the 12th. Whoa. When's the last time we were basking in this stuff? 39 degrees right now, heading for the low 40s. And good afternoon and welcome to the Stan Turner Show right here on Club 1220 KLBB. Thank you very much for being with us. You know, our mission statement here basically is to, you know, try to inform you and entertain you all at the same time. And it's a combination we try mightily to achieve every Saturday on the show, and I hope we do succeed. But thank you very much for your comments and your support and all the rest of it. Kyle, you're here on duty. There's no doubt about it. You look just like yourself. You know that, don't you?
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Nice to see you. How's everything? All getting set for the holidays, or just kind of let that blow right by you?
Hmm? Nope. All the presents are wrapped, ready to go. Trees up, lit.
Yeah. You're ahead of most of humanity. You know that, don't you?
Well, my I can't take a whole lot of credit
for it. Your wife
did
it, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Oh, that's wonderful, huh? You're a blessed man, my boy. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Well, folks, 1207 right now, and, well, we have... I'm going to ask you, do you live in or work in a house or a building that was built, say, between 1945 and 1965, do you? A lot of us do. Some interesting stories attached to where we live and work from that era. Very interesting, and we're going to delve into that with our good buddy Larry Millett in just a minute. But first of all here, I just want to mark an anniversary. It was 100 years ago today. 100 years ago today, a boy was born in an upstairs tenement at 415 Monroe Street, to be precise about it, in Hoboken, New Jersey. The boy was the only child of Italian immigrants. First name of the mother, Natalina or Dolly, and the father's name, Antonino Martino. They called him Marty. Their son's name, that bouncing baby boy, born on this date 100 years ago in Hoboken, Francis Albert Sinatra. That's right. Francis Albert. Unbelievable life story of this man. Whether you like him or loathe him or somewhere in between, he is a force to be reckoned with in pop culture in this country and, in fact, around the world. A lot of people are chiming in about Frank Sinatra, what they think. And one of them, interestingly, a political commentator most of the time, George Will, had an interesting piece on Frank Sinatra this past week, a syndicated column. George stepped out of the political path and delved into pop culture and focused on Frank. And see if you agree or disagree with what George Will wrote about Sinatra. I'll read you just an excerpt here. He said, Sinatra was many things, some of them regrettable. Libertine, bully, gangster groupie, but he unquestionably was the greatest singer of American songs. That's the opinion of George Will. Will goes on, how should an artist's character and private life condition our appreciation of his or her art? How, say, should knowledge of T.S. Eliot's anti-Semitism condition one's admiration for his poetry? With Sinatra, tune out the public personality and listen to his music. As Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, Benny Goodman, Jerry Mulligan, Oscar Peterson did, they all, according to the culture critic Terry Teachout, named Sinatra their most admired singer. In spite of the spectacular vulgarity of Sinatra's choices of friends and fun, he bequeathed to postwar America, a sense of style, even male elegance. And Will goes on, never mind the tawdriness so abundantly reported in the just-published second volume of James Kaplan's biography, Sinatra the Chairman, but you must remember this. In a recording studio, Sinatra, who could not read music, was a meticulous collaborator with great musicians and arrangers. For Sinatra, before a song was music, it was words alone. He studied lyrics, internalized them, then sang, making music from poems. His good fortune was, says George Will, that he, Sinatra, had one of the nation's cultural treasures, the Great American Songbook, to interpret. It was the good fortune of that book's authors, Cole Porter, the Gershwins, Johnny Mercer, and many others, that Sinatra came along to remind some Americans and inform others of that book's existence. In that American songbook, there are some fine holiday songs. Mel Torme wrote one of them, and Francis Albert Sinatra did a pretty fair job with it.
Mm-hmm. chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe can help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh, and every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
Well, there he is, Frank Sinatra, with an abrupt ending right there. His actual ending came in May of 1998 at the age of 82. Sinatra, Frank Sinatra, was buried in a blue business suit with mementos from family members, including, are you ready for this, cherry-flavored lifesavers, Tootsie Rolls, a bottle of Jack Daniels, a pack of Camel cigarettes, and a Zippo lighter. And there were stuffed toys and a dog biscuit in the casket with him, too. The words, "The best is yet to come," plus "beloved husband and father," are imprinted on Frank Sinatra's grave marker. So we remember Frank on this, the 100th anniversary of his birthday in Hoboken, New Jersey. There we are. 12:13 right now, 39 degrees in the Twin Cities. And as Frank himself might have said, here comes the main event, although he's not the main event this hour. Here we go. If I said something like, "Come on, let's learn all about mid-century modernism," as in architecture, you might head for the door or switch the dial. But wait. Don't let some dull-sounding words put you off. Let's come at it this way. Mid-century modernism is all about you and me, the kinds of places, the houses and the buildings we come into and go out of every day of our lives. Remember when, and this is part of it, Porky's Drive-Ins, remember those, huh? Ramblers and ranch houses, some with banana-shaped coffee tables and atomic clocks on the walls? Wow. As the dust was settling after World War II, clouds of construction dust were flying as America, including this place right here where we live, was remaking itself. The way we lived, where we lived, how we lived, and how we saw ourselves in this bold new post-war world. Out with the old and in with the new. Well then, the new architecture, yes, the shape and the function of things, penetrated the social, the political, and the cultural fabric of our times. And it still does. It affects all of us, whether we know it or not. Here in studio to tell us all about it is Larry Millett. Larry is a respected Minnesota architecture critic and historian. And yeah, he's a former ink-stained wretch, as in newspaper journalist. That's right. He's a frequent visitor to this program. Welcome back, Larry. Wretch? You're not a wretch, are you?
No,
ink stained. You've been called a wretch? Ink stained.
Yeah, I've been called a wretch several times.
Have you really? Huh?
By the way, when you mentioned that idea of Jack Daniels and Tootsie Rolls, yeah. I think I used to drink that in college. Tootsie Rolls in the glass.
Tootsie Rolls in the glass, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, good idea. Anyway.
You always did follow Frank's lead, didn't you? Well, Larry is here, a good guy that he is. He always likes to stop by here, but he's out with a hefty new tome, a new book that's called Minnesota Modern Architecture and Life at Mid-Century, because the two are intertwined, aren't they, Mr.
They
Millett?
They certainly were.
Yeah.
And
it's not just a box with holes punched in the side for windows. This tells us about ourselves in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And you were certainly right in pointing out how all of us, whether we are aware of it or not, are still sort of consumers of mid-century architecture and many things that developed in the mid-century. The Twin Cities, as we know them now, really were a product of the suburban growth in the mid-century period.
We're going to have you walk us through what life was like, especially right here in the Twin Cities, right after the end of World War II. But I shouldn't say this, but that's why I'm going to say it. Modern architecture, Larry, by and large, leaves me cold. It's not my favorite thing. I've never much liked it. I think of glass block buildings and ribbons of horizontal windows along slab-sided structures, kind of boxy. Sometimes it's a strange combination of glitzy and bland. I don't know how that works, but sometimes. Give me the old Victorian and the Edwardian and Second French Empire. Is that what it's called? Something like that. Design.
French Second Empire, yeah.
Here we're sitting right now in this radio station inside an 1880 building built by Stillwater's first mayor, McCusick, who in a fit of vanity named it after himself. But it's got the high ceilings. It used to have a very nice facade. It used to be three stories tall. Now two, the top one taken off by fire, weren't they all some years ago? But there's something comforting to me about the architecture of old. But I'm come to realize, reading your book, Minnesota Modern, that there's more to this modern stuff than meets my untrained eye. And so we're going to talk about it today. And your book, and I mentioned I'm going to have you, if you would please, kind of give us an overview of what the Twin Cities look like right after the end of World War II.
Well, at the end of World War II, what's interesting is that the Twin Cities, first of all, were very much urban places. Three-quarters of the people in what we think of as the Twin Cities metropolitan area lived in either St. Paul or Minneapolis proper. The statistics that I like to trot out that's kind of everyone is amazed to hear is that the largest suburb in the Twin Cities was South St. Paul.
South St. Paul,
in 1945,
right.
by far.
My eyebrows went way sky high when I read that in your book. South St. Paul,
yeah.
Hookham Cowway.
Yep. It was the biggest suburb. We had 12,000 people, and the next closest one was St. Louis Park, which only had 8,000.
That's my place,
yeah.
Where I grew up. But it was what, the meatpacking industry? The
meatpacking industry, yeah.
South St. Paul.
So the Twin Cities in 1945 was still dominated by the two cities. 1945, they were still cutting ice on Cedar Lake in Minneapolis for ice boxes. There was still a working farm in South Minneapolis, far South Minneapolis. It was just a much different world. And when the war ended, that changed very quickly. And what drove it all, drove the suburban development, drove all the changes, well, probably two things, the automobile, certainly, but housing. Everyone was looking for a place to live.
Where were we living in 1945? In apartments, basically?
We were living in apartments, rooming houses. Keep in mind, Minneapolis reached its maximum population of 520,000+ people in 1950.
There was no more room in the inn.
There was room to build, and actually the first sort of wave of new construction that occurred after the war, some of the first was in Minneapolis and St. Paul proper, and what was left of undeveloped land, like in Highland Park, far south Minneapolis. And then, of course, it just spread out very, very quickly to the suburbs, and there was a lot of kind of leapfrogging going on. You know, somebody would get a chunk of land to put up houses. It all happened very fast. But there was such tremendous pent-up demand for housing. We had people living in Quonset huts.
Right.
We had Quonset hut villages all around the Twin Cities right after the war.
Can you explain what those were for people who don't remember? Or
well,
know?
The Quonset hut was that little metal hut that was developed during World War II. With an arch shape to it and designed to be built very quickly in a day by a relatively unskilled group of people. Kind of, you just put it together real fast. And after the war, there were a lot of Quonset huts available. And the housing situation was so bad that they actually built these Quonset hut villages, including one in your St. Louis Park, after the war. And they had two families per Quonset hut. It was, people were just desperate to find a place to live.
My family, we lived in a basement, in the basement of our home. My father built the house, but in common with most of the other houses in the neighborhood, we were in that basement that was covered over until we got the money.
We got
the money to build the rest of the house on top of it.
And so, I've actually got a picture of one of the basement houses in the book. And yes, that was not unheard of, living in the basement house. And then we get the money, or in some cases, right after the war, it was just a matter of getting materials.
Right. That's true. Right.
Yeah.
So St. Paul, Minneapolis, pretty much the same story in both towns then.
Yeah.
70% of the population lived within the city confines of St. Paul and Minneapolis.
Yeah, 75%. And now, of course, the figure is reversed. It's like, I think, 80% live in the suburbs and
exactly.
Only 20% in St. Paul, Minneapolis proper.
And back in the early 50s, maybe late 40s, the average age of getting married was 19. People started early on.
So yep.
All kinds of changes. That's not the case anymore. Many things have changed along with the architecture that's accommodated the people of the so-called modern age. By the way, by happy coincidence, your book, Minnesota Modern, coincides with a wonderful exhibit at the Minnesota Historical Society, the Minnesota History Center, right on Kellogg there, just down the hill from the cathedral, called Suburbia.
Yep. And
this
it's
is what it's all about, isn't it?
It is, and it's a really a fun exhibit with lots of memorabilia from that age and how people lived, and it's a lot of fun. And I talk about some of the same things in my book. We actually share some pictures with the with the exhibit, but it's a lot of fun.
The book is a lot of fun. You think, oh, architecture, as I said at the outset, it doesn't sound very sexy, but it really is about our lives here, about how we've transformed ourselves, almost a reflection of a changing lifestyle, isn't it, architecture, the way buildings are built, their shapes.
Yeah, and, you know,
a new
right...
vision of who we are.
Yeah, and right after the war, I mean, obviously automobiles had been around, but this was really when the automobile culture that we think of today, the suburban automobile culture, really developed. The book opens with a picture of the very first cloverleaf.
That's what I want to
interchange.
Talk about.
Yes.
That's right. That's a mile from where I grew up. And Larry, let's take a break here, and we're going to come back and talk about the significance of that cloverleaf that I believe was built in 1937. Right?
That is correct.
And a lot of significance, a lot of importance attached to that, as Larry said here. We'll be back with Larry Millett right after this.
Jaime's Haberdashery presents the Jaime's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's Oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater. Guten Tag. This is Stan Turner, and I would like to personally invite you to join me on a tour of the Alpine highlights of Austria and Germany next September. We'll stay in quaint Austrian and Bavarian villages. We'll visit Berchtesgaden and the stunning views from the Eagle's Nest. We will be joined by a local guide as we discover Salzburg, known from the film The Sound of Music. These are just two of the highlights of our 8-day, 7-night tour of the Alpine highlights of Austria and Germany. Airfare, transportation, and daily breakfast and dinner are included. However, seating is limited. So join me. Please call Defined Destinations at 651-398-9358. That's 651-398-9358 or online at defineddestinations.com. So come along. Austria and Germany await us next fall. Call 651-398-9358. We are back here. Thank you very much for being with us. We're talking about, well, you could call it architecture. We're talking about our lives, our transformed lives here in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities, and across America. Minnesota Modern, Architecture and Life at Mid-Century. Larry Millett, our in-studio guest. You know Larry has written all kinds of wonderful books. Larry, I think I've got every one of your books, a lot of them on architecture, a lot of them on lost architectural treasures, lost buildings, lost Twin Cities is one of your books.
God bless bless you.
Oh, thank you. I'm only missing one, and holidays are here. Hint, hint. I only have one book of yours. That, I mean, I'm still have one I don't have. It's called The Curve of the Arch, which I believe is your very first book.
My very first book, yes. Going back so many years that it's all kind of receded into the mist of time.
I can see that. It's very foggy, isn't it? If you do find a tattered old volume in your basement, you send it my way, will you? Because my Larry Millett bookshelf looks like a swayback horse. You write hefty tomes, don't you?
I call them epic tomes.
Epic tomes. Doorstops that are meant to be read.
Yeah, exactly.
Really good.
We hope so.
This one's about the changing architectural landscape around here, which means our lives, the way we live, from about 1945 to 1965. Before the break, Larry, we were talking about a photograph, the very first big photograph one encounters in your new book, Minnesota Modern, published by U of M Press. Thank you very much. Yes. Got all that in there. Cloverleaf, an aerial view of a cloverleaf that was built in 1937. Your photograph, I think, dates to 53. And, I grew up about a mile west of there, and there is not any significance attached to where I grew up, but the cloverleaf is significant.
Did you, play in the leaves of the clover?
I did. My mother used to be in the backyard picking four-leaf clovers out of the lawn for good luck, and she said, go down to the cloverleaf and play.
Well, there are two funny things about the first cloverleaf, and one of the funniest things that because it's, the cloverleaf was invented in New Jersey, where else, by a highway engineer, nearly 20th century. But the first one in Minnesota was at Highway 100 and Highway 12, built in 1937. And what's interesting about it is that the newspapers were publishing articles telling people how to negotiate your way through the cloverleaf. if you wanted to turn left, you actually had to turn right, you see, to do that. The other great story was that I've heard stories of people who said that when the cloverleaf opened, their parents would take them for drives, and they'd do the whole loop-de-loop, all four leaves of the clover.
We were hours on that cloverleaf.
Yeah, and it was like a little ride, you know.
It was so novel.
But think about it. I mean,
did people really do that, Larry?
Yes,
they did.
Yeah, they did. And there are so many things you sort of take for granted. But we can all. I can remember the first time I ever drove on a freeway. Through the Twin Cities in the 60s and how novel that seemed.
What was it like, Larry?
Yeah. Oh, it was exciting. There was less traffic than there is now.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No bikers in the bike lane. There were no bike lanes. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh man! But so the cloverleaf was a harbinger.
The automobile culture and how the suburbs were organized. And highway building was very much a part. Freeway building, interstate building was very much a part of the mid-century era. It goes back to the mid-50s, and we started seeing the land being cleared already for freeways through the Twin Cities in the 50s. A lot of them were built in the 60s. So it was all part of that new world that was being made very, very rapidly all around the Twin Cities and around every other major city in the United States.
So who decided that we had to do away with the gables and the turrets and the Queen Anne homes and all those things and get into something entirely new?
Well, the architectural modernism goes way back, and it's one of those subjects that many, many books have been written about, most of which I don't recommend that you read. but there were three sources for what happened. One, of course, was European modernism going back to the Bauhaus and all that sort of stuff, the flat roofs, the very plain-looking buildings. The ranch house, which came out of California. In the 1930s. And the other big influence was much closer to home, Mr. Frank Lloyd Wright.
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's own, yeah, Big Frank. Mm-hmm. And his work was tremendously influential on the design of houses in the 50s, especially high-style houses. And, keep in mind that Wright in the 1950s was the most famous architect, not only of his day, but I don't think there's ever been in American history an architect who was more famous, more known to the public than Frank Lloyd Wright was in the 1950s.
Steve Cannon, the late Steve Cannon, used to call him Frank Lloyd Wrong.
Yeah. I'm sure that's been uttered a few times.
It has. And Larry, I'm wondering how Frank Lloyd Wright had time to do his architecture when he was running, squiring young ladies, other than ladies not his wife. He was his notorious womanizer, wasn't he?
Well,
where he got his architectural inspiration?
No, but as he got older, I think he settled down a little bit. Keep in mind, in the 50s, he was 80 years old. He was in his he was 80 and going and actually reached 90 before he died, 91. So he was a very old man, but very, very vital. And because he had staff, he had people. by that time.
He had people.
But he traveled around the country. I mean, he had so much fun. He traveled around the country. He'd stay at his, wherever he had a client, he'd stay at their house. He'd just call them up and say, I'll be here next weekend. Put me up.
He was a sponger.
Mm-hmm. And then the press would gather, and he'd go on a little walk somewhere and deliver some outrageous statement. He was like Trump before Trump. And just had so much fun that you just
That's lousy. That's no good. That house is crummy.
It's terrible. I didn't do it. It must be bad.
Tell the listeners what he said about Southdale, the then brand new shopping, first of its kind enclosed shopping mall in America.
He was out there in '56 when it opened, and he criticized the heck out of it. Said it wasn't very gracious. He didn't particularly appreciate it. Wasn't very good. And the truth of the matter is, I think he was right. He had himself a lot of fun, let's put it that way.
But he had an influence on our architecture.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And not just people with big budgets.
Right. Okay. No, his Usonian houses, he really developed a middle class, relatively affordable middle class house that was also high style. Mm-hmm. And that was one of his goals, to do that. And relatively affordable is the key term here. you could build a house in 1950 for $10,000 or less.
Orrin Thompson, one of the developers that helped the middle class.
Absolutely.
I would guess that his homes were priced lower than Mr. Wright's homes.
Yes, but the Thompson was really the first big mega house builder in the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. We think of that as now being more common, but he was huge, and I can still remember going out to Coon Rapids, where I knew someone when I was a kid in North Minneapolis, and it's being this incredibly raw but really fascinating new world.
Raw world.
Yeah.
What do you mean raw?
I mean it was like still dirt streets.
Wow.
Some of these early suburbs, what's interesting is that they had no sewer system, so everybody had their own cesspools, and you can imagine,
I think we'll take a detour off that right now. I got the flavor, as it were, of what you're talking about there. You mentioned part of this, ramblers and ranch houses, single-story family dwellings. Your book, you mentioned that some of these, what were they, ranch houses were so sprawling, so big, that you had to go outside your house to get into your bedrooms. I can hear the mother saying to little Johnny, put on your parka and your scarf because I want you to go to your room.
Now, here's the thing, though. That did not happen in Minnesota. That was California.
Well, it would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah. No builder in Minnesota was quite that stupid.
Quite that stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Remember that theater they built here some years back, and they decided that from some big national chain, they decided to put the ticket booth.
That's at Rosedale.
Outside.
The new theater, you would queue up in 20 below weather to buy your tickets. Can you believe that some clown from some gentleman from California.
What were they thinking? Yeah.
They weren't.
Yeah. So, no, we didn't have those kind of ranch houses.
But you did
Minnesota.
Have to go outside to get in your bedroom.
There are some examples of that in California. It was the ultimate sort of casual lifestyle. I could picture Hef doing it.
Hefner. Yeah, another influence from California. I mentioned Porky's in my introduction today. The drive-ins.
The drive-ins.
Four of them around the metro area. I used to have one by Calhoun.
Yep, I did too. We used to play mini golf by the putt-putt there.
Yep, the putt-putt, and they would not let us get out of our cars. We had to stay in our cars to order, and young car hops on roller skates would bring our hamburgers to us. Porky's. So Porky's, in a sense, was derived from something in California called Googie. It's before Google. It's Googie.
Googie-style architecture.
What?
Yep.
What the devil was that?
Well, it's sort of that kind of freewheeling California modernism, and it was named after a coffee shop in California, and there was a whole coffee shop called.
Come on, Larry, let's go on
in
down
LA.
To Googie.
Let's go down and go to Googie's and have some coffee. And there were fabulous drive-ins in California. And here again, Minnesota, the drive-in architecture tended to be a little less grand because, number one, it was a very seasonal business compared to what you would get in California. So, but a lot of the modernism that we saw in the 50s definitely was influenced by what was happening in California.
You have a photo of a Googie-like coffee shop in California. It looks like a flying saucer just landed.
Yeah.
And so Porky's was kind of a spin-off pun intended of that, not quite as flamboyant and crazy.
No, but you did have the originally, I believe it was at the yellow and black stripes. I can't remember the original color scheme, but it was tasteful.
Tasteful. It
was quietly tasteful.
A pig's head with a tilted top hat. Was that it?
Porky's? Yeah. The sign.
Remember those, Kyle? You don't. Then they were gone before you got out there on the street.
Well, I also have the oldest Dairy Queen in the Twin Cities.
Really?
In the book from, and still there.
That's right.
1947.
Tell us where that is.
That is at Lexington and Larpinter in
still
Roosevelt.
Got the blue Dairy Queen sign.
They still got the blue Dairy Queen sign, and it's a one of a kind with the, it looks sort of like a little airport control tower. Yeah. Yeah. It's very cool.
As a matter of fact, Larry, it is a control tower.
It is.
No, for drones.
For drones.
For drones now. Folks, architecture is fun. It really is, because it is in the fabric of our lives here. So we've got all these influences. Europe, we got Frank Lloyd Wright over from Wisconsin. He was friendly to the environment, wasn't he? He tried to build his houses in harmony with the existing land.
To the extent that often he let the rain come right in through
the roof. Right in through his
roof. Very, very harmonious approach to
what
design.
What did he care? He was sponging off somebody else where he was never home.
He was very careful about how he sited and how his buildings fit into their environment, and he was justly famous for his work along those lines.
The federal government, well, all levels of government, take a heavy rap these days in a lot of ways. But back then, in the 50s especially, the federal government was really a positive, benevolent force in helping people get into homes. The FHA. You write about that in your book. What does that stand for?
Federal Housing Administration. Pretty much that financed the whole development of the suburbs. Most people had either, well, of course, also through the veterans loans, veterans and FHA loans. The dark side of that was that it was also a very prejudicial system for blacks and other people of color.
Absolutely.
And that had an impact on why the suburbs as they developed were so white, because it was very difficult for black people. It's an interesting era. I mean, it really was good, bad, a whole mix of things, both architecturally and culturally.
Speaking of good, bad, why don't you give us an example of some really fine, outstanding, good pieces of structural architecture in terms of buildings, churches, that sort of non-residential buildings that are maybe still standing?
Well, one of the things that I was impressed with when I did the book and hadn't really thought about that much was the quality of the churches. During the mid-century era, I mean, you had St. John's Abbey Church, which is considered an international masterpiece. Christ Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, which was immensely influential. Beautiful St. Columba here in St. Paul, amazing church. There were a lot of really outstanding churches. There were a lot of outstanding houses. Office buildings, things like that, a lot of it was pretty plain. But we've got things like the old Northwestern National Life Building, which I, of course, I always...
You're not a huge fan of that one, are you?
No, actually, no. It's somewhere between high art and high kitsch. I can never quite decide where it is, but I always tell people, you know the building, it's the one at the end of the Nicollet Mall with the big white columns. I always tell people that its new use, eventual use, will be as Liberace's tomb. That's my theory, anyway.
Okay. And any other buildings, church, office?
Well, you know, one of the buildings
that high watermark.
One of the buildings I really loved in downtown Minneapolis, especially when I was young, because it went up when I was young, was the old Lutheran Brotherhood building, which later became Minnegasco. Just a beautiful little green glass building, very delicate, very elegant little building. And of course, it got trashed to make a much bigger, larger, less interesting skyscraper. And there was some very nice stuff. Some of the schools were very well done. And the high style houses of the period are among, I think, the best houses ever built in this country.
Where I grew up in St. Louis Park, the Basswood area, I remember, over by Cedar Lake?
Yep.
Beautiful 1950s.
Yeah, there's two streets there, Basswood and Cedarwood, that both have a nice array of 50s and 60s mid-century houses. And those houses have come back into style and popularity now. Mm-hmm.
I was not in those neighborhoods, Larry. I was in the...
You were living in the Quonset.
I was, just about.
Yeah,
just about.
Yeah. Did you have your own Quonset?
I did, and like Frank Lloyd Wright, he designed my Quonset. The roof leaked.
Yeah, well,
so
you can't have everything. It was
always watered, yes. Yeah. And then along came, in the midst of all this, urban renewal.
Yes, indeed.
The dreaded urban renewal.
Well, that was sort of the dark reverse side of what was happening. Everybody's going out to the suburbs, including corporations.
Absolutely.
You know, General Mills built its headquarters. Prudential has the building out there, 3M. They're going out to the suburbs.
We're going to talk about it. Larry, if we can just take a breather here.
We'll
get back on urban renewal, the good and the bad. And there's a fair amount of bad, too. We'll be right back with Larry Millett. Yes, the author of Minnesota Modern Architecture and Life. Yep, how we were, the way we were at mid-century, right after this.
Hi, I'm Kathy Wolf Swanson. And hey, I'm Pat Wolf. Our motto has always been to ask for Wolf. But Prohibition forced our family to stop brewing Wolf beer. To this day, our legacy can still be seen all over Stillwater. So it's only fitting, Kathy, that Wolf beer is back in the valley, especially after a 93-year dry spell. Don't you think Great-Grandpa Joe would be so proud? I do. And that's why we invite you to visit wolfbrewing.com and click on Beer Finders to locate a store near you. And then ask for Wolf's. Stillwater's original craft beer.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater.
Jaime's Haberdashery presents the Jaime's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's Oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
Doing a little time tripping here, 1945 to 1965, all about architecture, yeah, change, a big change in architecture, where we live, where we work, and how it affected our lives at mid-century. And we're still living in those places, a lot of us. It really is very much with us. Larry Millett, author of a new book from U of M Press, Minnesota Modern, The Architecture and Life at Mid-Century. And most of the focus of the book, of course, is Minnesota, but Larry tells us how this all came to pass. And a moment ago, I want to mention that you will be at Valley Bookseller. We just heard a message about Valley Bookseller right here in downtown Stillwater. You'll be there just a while, 2 o'clock.
I will be.
All right, that's good. Where else are you going to be? Do you have a list?
I'm going to be, tomorrow, I'm going to be at Majors and Quinn in Minneapolis at 2 p.m. That's the other big sign
coming
up.
Okay, very good. Well, Larry, we were talking about urban renewal. I remember, what did Prince Charles of Britain once say? He said about London and its need to remake itself. He said, I think the German Luftwaffe did more for urban renewal in London than any number of architects and bulldozers. Did not go over well with the folks, especially the East End.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it was very much tied into the whole mid-century period of growth and change. And as the suburbs developed and corporations moved out to the suburbs, jobs moved out to the suburbs, the downtown, people were very concerned about what was happening to the downtown. You were having freeways coming through the downtowns, and you had a lot of federal money available for curing what they called blight.
Blight.
So it was a tool that was used, unfortunately, not with much discrimination. And so you had a lot of destruction in both downtown. Some of it was very old and decrepit buildings that definitely the time had come to make changes, but unfortunately they didn't always apply it well. And
case in point, maybe what, the Capitol Approach area in St. Paul?
Capitol Approach area in St. Paul.
That was kind of slummy, parts of it, right?
Well, very much so, right. But also, I've always contended, this is one of my private beliefs, but I'll voice
please,
it here.
Please.
The Capitol Mall is too darn big.
Really?
I always thought it was too darn big.
Cass Gilbert, the architect of the Capitol, I believe, wanted to run the approach all the way down to the river.
Well, he had a grand boulevard that
he
was going to go all the way down to the High Bridge, but of course you had to like plow up about 40 city blocks to accomplish that.
So you think the approach as it is today is too big?
Too big.
Capitol approach.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was and A and B, the freeway should have been put behind the Capitol, not in front of it.
Ah, amen.
But there's reasons for that as well. But Minneapolis, the famous case is the destruction of the Metropolitan Building, which made no sense. And
the Ryan Hotel in St. Paul.
And the Ryan Hotel in St. Paul, same deal. That's what I meant. There was just a lack of discrimination in terms of what you did. Everything went out. They just threw everything out, unfortunately, and that was a great loss for both cities.
Sledgehammer approach, where a scuffle would have been much better.
Exactly.
A wrecking ball. Tell us about the Gateway District. I think as a kid, I can remember a very young boy, my father driving me down Washington Avenue one night to show me the neon jungle. I remember
did he take you to the Persian Palms for a little entertainment?
I did not go inside because as a I'm certain my father never saw the inside of that place. It was a strip joint, wasn't it? Huh?
I think it was a nightclub perhaps some suspicious forms of entertainment occurred. I don't know the details.
You have a number in your book as to the number of bars, saloons in that area. It was large.
Yeah.
And this brings us to, you're a wordsmith. You love to use words that we normally don't hear or use very often. Tenderloin, you apply to this gateway, this tumble-down, roughneck part of Minneapolis.
The Tenderloin.
Tell us, we're not talking about steaks here and meat. tell us what Tenderloin meant in that context.
Tenderloin, Skid Row, there are lots of different words to use that sort of down-at-the-heels part of town. And the Gateway District of Minneapolis was, best known for the fact that you had this very large population of mostly single men who had been loggers, farm workers, people like that, who were often retired, living down there as cheaply as they could. Mm-hmm. And lots of alcohol.
Alcohol-soaked, I think, is the term you use in your book.
Lots of alcohol. So it was definitely a rundown part of town that was in need of some help. But, again, they destroyed everything when it would have been much more sensible to pick and choose and deal with the really, really run-down buildings. But that wasn't the way things were done.
How does it look today, the Gateway? To your eye.
Well, I mean, it's not very interesting. It's full of most of the modern buildings that replaced the older stuff weren't very good, with the exception of something like the Northwestern National Life Building. But it's interesting that a number of the buildings that were built in the Gateway right at the time the older buildings were destroyed are already gone. Like the Ritz Hotel, remember that?
Yes, I do.
Hotel.
It was just a cube, wasn't it?
But it had that great pink parking ramp.
It did.
And it had an outdoor pool in downtown Minneapolis sitting right on the street.
Which you could use maybe 3 or 4 weeks a year.
Well, then they finally put a pyramid over it. It became the pyramid pool. It's like the
Louvre. The Louvre.
Like the Louvre, only not quite the same art collection, from what I understand. But,
this was paint by number.
The Mona Lisa didn't find it there. But... there were some very cool things. My other favorite of that whole, I noticed in the studio here, you've got a picture of the Rat Pack, the domed cocktail lounge atop the Cap Tower.
Oh, sure.
Which is still there, but it's no longer a cocktail lounge.
Didn't it? Did it revolve? Yeah.
Well, no, it didn't revolve. No. That was the...
St. Paul.
St. Paul, yeah. Okay. But no, they had that cool domed cocktail lounge where you could sit up and... It just felt like you should be drinking martinis and smoking cigarettes.
And a lot of people were.
Those were the days.
Life through the bottom of a cocktail glass.
But that whole idea of being very swankly modernist was very important at that time. And you had some really wonderful modern spaces that did a good job of that.
Today's young people, as you and I call
them. The young people.
Those young people. 20s and 30s, they are drawn, many of them, to this kind of architecture.
Mid-century modernism.
What's the attraction?
Well, it's new to their eyes. They're interested not only in the architecture, but particularly interested in the furnishings of the period. You know, the mid-century era was not only an interesting period for architecture, but maybe the greatest age of furniture design in American history.
It was a very
dynamic period of design. You had the Danish modern, which was more buttoned down, but you also had the kind of wild blob-like furniture. You had
lava lamps.
You had lava lamps. You had those fish on the walls everywhere. There were lots of interesting things going on in furniture design, and big designers like the Eames and George Nelson and others who were doing really exceptional furniture, and that all worked its way into the look of the period as well. And that's very popular. That's becoming very popular again. And what's also we're also seeing is that all that stock of mid-century houses out there, new people are coming in and saying, you know what, I can work with this house. It's not too big. It's simple. And people are adding on to them, and it's it's very much alive. Mid-century modern is still very much alive.
Maybe that so-called modern architecture has the same kind of attraction to today's 20 and 30-year-olds that, rock and roll from the 50s does.
Yeah.
It's new to them. They they haven't heard it.
Yeah.
They've heard covers, and they didn't know they were covers of Little Richard's song and Jerry Lee Lewis. And you walk into Macy's these days, and they're pumping music from the 1950s rock and roll era in there because it's new to the kids.
That's to keep out you and me.
That, well, no, that attracts me. That works. If that's the intent, it's not working.
Yeah, yeah. No, it really is become, and I think part of it is that mid-century modernism was a distinctive style, and you look at what's being built mostly today, and you ask yourself, what style is it?
Yeah, really, it's true.
It's very
true.
Vague and...
Mish meets mash.
Yeah, it is. And this is something that I think people look back and say, hey, you know what, maybe this is... At least they had an idea what they were doing.
That's true.
I'm not so sure they
had. Yeah. Larry Millett's Minnesota Modern, Architecture and Life in Mid-Century. There were some planned communities, weren't there, of varying degrees of success. I remember
Jonathan. Kind of late. That's kind of more into the 70s. But, yeah, and of course, the greatest planned community was the Minnesota Experimental City.
Appelstan Spillhouse. Somebody invented that name, Appelstan Spillhouse.
And they were going to have the big dome, you know, and we're going to live under the dome before even...
A dome over an entire metro area.
That was a proposal, yeah. Never went anywhere, but I think Stephen King thought it up. I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, they were going to build this giant city in the middle of Aiken County in the woods, and the people in Aiken County were like, "What? What are you talking about?" And the other, but the planned community that you can see to this day, if you want, from the 50s, is Silver Bay.
Silver Bay. That surprised me. When I saw the photograph in your book, it's an aerial photograph. I thought it was one you had in one of your previous books of cottage, packed housing in Cottage Grove, right?
And that's the way, that's the way they did it. I mean, it's like, you want to build a planned community in the 50s? Okay, you're going to build your Ramblers and your Inn. You're going to have your little shopping mall, your little church over there, and that's...
Silver Bay, a company town.
A company town,
reserve mining.
That was built from scratch in the 50s.
Where is it today?
It's still there.
Is it still occupied?
I assume it's with the... big plants. I'm not sure if it has the number
mining?
Of people that it had. Yeah.
That was a...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
The Miles Lord case.
The taconite tailings, pollution.
Who can forget that?
Who can, indeed, maybe. Okay, any other planned communities, some of which came to fruition and some did not? Jonathan, what's the status of that?
It's still around.
Near Jordan?
It's still around.
I never hear anybody say, hey, I'm from Jonathan.
Is it part of Chanhassen or... Oh. Part of another community, but no, there wasn't. I mean, what was surprising to look at, you know, you think of how enormously fast the suburbs developed after World War II. What is startling about it is how little planning there was. I mean, it was a free for all. You know, the small builders mostly started out after the war. They'd buy an acre here, a few acres there, throw up houses, and away you went. And there was just very little planning for schools, for anything beyond just getting those houses up as fast as you could.
Is there another wave now, or have we moved beyond Minnesota modern, so-called?
You have another wave of...
Architectural style and lifestyle?
I don't know. I struggle to know what the heck the style of the moment is.
Some
people call it the style of many gables. Gables seem to be everywhere, but beyond that, I can't tell you much.
I've got to mention this. Something in the Star Trib yesterday that's just a hoot. Headline, Streetscapes, No Tears for Teardown of Forgettable TCF Bank Building downtown Minneapolis. James Lilacs wrote this thing, and they're going to tear down the TCF Bank.
It's a great loss for Western civilization, as we know it.
I want to read a piece of Lilacs' piece. This is from the 1970s, isn't it? So it's just, it could be maybe considered part of the modern. I don't know. You want to disown that, don't you? The TCF Bank Building certainly sums up the 1970s. Lilacs writes, half a block of dark brown brick. Could be a bank. Could be offices, could be the Gerald R. Ford Mausoleum. Could have been beautiful. There's nothing objectionable about large quantities of brick and dark hues that can project a certain earthy honesty. But then he says, so does a cow pie.
Oh, James.
Wow, James. Pretty strong words there.
Well, I mean, the 70s was also, you know, excellent for clothing. music.
Sideburns.
I had mutton chops.
Did
myself.
You? Yeah, sure. Glad you,
yeah, they
sure
look,
glad you lost those, Larry.
Yeah, I've been destroying the pictures. As soon as I find
but
them.
But I have negatives, my man, so I'm going to get that book of yours yet. Okay. Remember? Curve of the Arch.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
forget.
Curve of the Arch.
I want to see
yeah.
that in the mail yeah. one of these All days. Right. What are you working on next? You got some more books?
I'm working on a brand new Sherlock Holmes adventure.
Oh, good. Larry's done a number of Sherlock Holmes in Minnesota books,
this
right?
One is, yeah, this one is called Sherlock Holmes and the Eisenberg Enigma.
What?
And it's set in a mythical German town south of Rochester.
Eisenberg.
And Sherlock Holmes, I won't say too much.
No.
It's set in 1920, and the setup is that Sherlock Holmes is being treated at the Mayo Clinic for certain problems.
Is the name of the town Eisenberg?
Eisenberg,
E-I-S-E-N-B-E-R-G.
Mm-hmm, yep.
It's Iron Mountain in Germany, which you probably know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's actually occupied by two big families, the Eisens and the Krupps.
The Krupps.
The Krupps. Krupps
style.
The Krupps.
Yep. Krupps deal. We won't go into the political leanings of those people.
Yeah.
But how about Benedict Cumberbatch? You know the entire Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle canon. What do you think of Cumberbatch on the...
I like him a lot.
So do I.
That's one of my favorite Sherlocks. And as I always say, if I can understand what's going on, because they talk so fast and so Britishly...
It's their language.
It's their language, but it's
we
not,
stole
quite,
it
it's not
corrupted
quite English.
It.
And so I have a little trouble following them. But no, what impresses me about that series is the quality of the writing as a writer. I think they're very clever the way they've taken original stories and updated them.
Mm-hmm.
Everything right up to John Watson serving in Afghanistan.
That's right.
Which tells you something about the history of Afghanistan.
It certainly does. And it's not very pretty, is it?
No.
Well, Sherlock Holmes, you brung Sherlock to... how many books on Sherlock have you written now?
Well, I've got, let's see, I think I've got, this will be the seventh or eighth.
If you don't know the number, you've written lot of them, haven't
well,
you?
This will be the eighth, book in which Sherlock is involved.
And you carefully researched this, so you know for sure that Sherlock, at the moment you bring him to Minnesota, was not otherwise occupied than Arthur Conan Doyle.
I want to make sure that, you know, he's free to do his thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so.
Your previous book, last time you visited us, a wonderful, great big pictorial and text piece here on Minnesota's big houses and called Minnesota's Own. These are lovingly restored mansions around the state. Huh?
Yep. And that book is still out and about and doing well. And that was a lot of fun to do. A book on some of the great houses in Minnesota.
Some of the usual suspects.
I have a mid-century modern house in that book.
The last house
in there was a 1950 house.
Whose is on the cover of your book, Minnesota Modern?
That is the Elam House in Austin, Minnesota.
Not my house, is it? No.
And it's the largest of all of Frank Lloyd Wright's houses in Minnesota.
Right.
It's a 4,500 square foot Usonian. It's a magnificent house. Only had two family ownership through the years.
Okay.
So it's a great house.
Wow, terrific house indeed.
Well,
good. Any more architecture books coming down the line or anything about, you've written so much about preservation. Lost Twin Cities. I think you've done more than any 10 people have done to further the cause of building preservation in this state.
Thank you. I'm thinking about doing a book on the ultimate book on the history of downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis, but I don't know if it's going to happen or not. I'm looking to raise some money and things like that, but it could happen. We'll see.
I just had a signal. You will do it. Okay. That's great. Larry Millette, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you
for another great book, Minnesota Modern Architecture and Life at Mid-Century here. Thank you so much for being with us, folks. Have a great weekend. I'm going to take the day off on Monday from the show, not from life. I'm going to be out at the VA Center, the Veterans Administration Center, to do a holiday program out there. I have the opportunity and the honor to MC a holiday choral program. Be back with the music show on Tuesday as normal. So please join us then. Great weekend, everybody. Bye-bye.